This recording has been released into the public domain by the Bonson Institute, where we aim to bring into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ.
So welcome back this morning. I see that we've lost a few people. Last night I was grateful for the baseball strike. I figured that helped swell our numbers a bit, but I forgot that Woodstock 94 was starting today. Here we were talking about the Doors and Johnny B. Goode and all that, and I guess some people just decided they had better things to do. But for the few and the high-quality people that have come back this morning, I welcome you. You obviously have made a better choice. Thank you very much. We're talking about getting down and dirty and defending the faith. The reason why I've chosen that title is because that's kind of a theme having to do with the method you should use when people challenge the Christian faith. I'm convinced more and more that in our society, when people dismiss the claims of Christianity, they're doing it with soundbite-type criticisms, just real surfacey, quick, catchy little things to try to get rid of the authoritative claims of Scripture and the need to bow the knee to Jesus Christ. And so God's people need to, realizing that most people are just giving some kind of shallow, easy answer, stop and say, well, let's talk about that for a minute. Let's get a little down and dirty with the details. There's a method to the progression of my lectures this weekend. Last night I started with what I think is the most pervasive, popular reason why people think you can't trust the Bible, and that's that it's been discredited with respect to origins. The Bible teaches creation, but we all know, the science has shown, that man came about through evolution. And people will say that, and they'll say it and get away with it, because in our society, that is the spirit of the age. And it's the reigning dogmatism in the universities. And everybody takes for granted, well, Christians and fundamentalists have been made fools over and over again over this, and science is on the side of evolution. So last night, I tried to give you just a few details, things you should remember in a discussion with somebody, if you get into it, about origins. If they say, well, evolution has shown that the Genesis account isn't correct, you say, well, let's talk about what I call amoebas, the origin of life. Let's talk about this prebiotic chemical stage of evolution. Because if you know anything about the literature in the field right now, the scientists who are working in this area say they are at an impasse. It does not appear that there's going to be any way to demonstrate that by random combination of chemicals you can get life. Talk to them about the eighth stage, what I used as the illustration of moving from life to diverse life forms or biological forms. Darwin said if there's one complex organ that cannot be accounted for by gradual, successive, beneficial changes, my whole theory is destroyed. Well, one of last night, I gave you three or four, and I was just taking from the text that I was using a handful. Over and over and over again, you cannot account for things such as the development of the flight feather of a bird or the development of the lungs of a bird and so forth, because all other forms are so different, you'd never be able to move from, remember, the U-turn type of lung construction that every other vertebrate has to the straight flow of the lung of a bird. And so evolution doesn't work well at the amoeba stage, it doesn't work well at the ape stage, and it's a terrible attempt at explanation of what makes man distinctive in terms of his abstract reasoning ability, his moral judgments, his creativity, his linguistic powers. And so you have plenty to talk about. Get down and dirty with people when they say, well, evolution's been discredited. You say, well, you know, not everybody sees it that way. I wonder, does anybody have an answer for this? Talk it through with people. But then secondly, let's say you get past that. The person who doesn't want to submit to the gospel will say, well, yeah, I suppose maybe we need a creator God, if nothing else, to get evolution started or to govern it or something like that. But the fact that we need a creator God doesn't mean we need this creator God, because there are other religions in the world. I couldn't talk about all of them. But the one that is thought by most people to be the competitor with Christianity, because it has many structural similarities, is Islam. So people say, well, why the Bible? Why not the Quran? Why take the prophets of the Bible if you have Muhammad? After all, Allah is a personal God, he's a creator God, he's a sovereign God, he's got a divine revelation. And given the fact that we have all these options out there, people will then say, so I guess it's just a toss-up, you can pick whatever you want. What strategy do you use at that point? Get down dirty. Say, well, let's talk about details. It is true. There's another alleged revelation out here from a personal creator God, or so it's alleged. But do you know anything about the Quran? Do you know anything about the other inspired source for Islamic thought? Do you know the Hadith? And did you know, and then you start talking some of these details, that by inspiration, you're supposed to believe that Satan urinates in the ears of people. Did you know that? Did you know you're supposed to believe that Adam was 90 feet tall? Did you realize that there were conflicts between the Hadith and the Quran? There are conflicts within the Quran, that the text has been altered, there are missing verses, and on and on. You don't have to be an expert. Now, every once in a while, maybe 1% or less of the time, you'll run into somebody who has studied Islam, or who has studied evolution, and so you may want to go a little bit deeper with them. But trust me, in the vast majority of cases, people are using soundbite criticisms. And the minute you pierce the thin surface of that criticism, you'll find out they're totally at a loss. In fact, they have to admit, oh, I didn't realize that science can't account for this, can't account for that. I didn't realize the Quran taught this, or the Hadith taught that, so forth. So that's the theme. Get down and dirty. But now let's follow this. Somebody says, evolution has discredited the Bible. You talk to them about that and they say, well, that doesn't look too hot. But then you don't have to have the Bible. You could have another, religious inspired book. Why not go with Islam? And so you say, well, do you know the message of Islam? Let's talk about that. So if you get past that, what will someone do when it appears that, well, if we're going to account for man's origin, we're going to have to go to a revelation from the Creator God. It looks like the Bible is going to be it. Oh, there's another out. So we come today to the question, well, can you even trust the text of the Bible? After all, the Bible was written hundreds of years ago, thousands of years ago, and it had to be copied by people. And you all know what it's like when you have to pass a message on from one person to another. In fact, in this room alone, just with the people we have here, if I were to start with a message here and have you all whisper it down the line, then the next thing, so forth, by the time we got back to this corner, that message will have been garbled. You've all played telephone, right? You know the game. People say, well, if you can't even, in the very same time period, the very same room with people who can check, keep a message clear, how could that possibly have been maintained over the years? Now, this is a very ignorant criticism. I know that. Those of you who've studied know that. But it's a very popular one nonetheless. People think, well, even if I have to go to the Bible, who knows what the Bible originally said? And so you just can't trust. In fact, I debated Edward Tavish, this lawyer at UC Davis, a few months ago. And I remember thinking to myself, I can't believe that an educated man would do this publicly in front of 1,100 people. But he said, in one of his cross-examination questions to me, he said, how can you believe in an inerrant Bible? How can you believe you even have the text of that, given the fact that this book was produced by ignorant, superstitious people years ago who didn't have the advantage of copy machines and computers? He said that. And I replied to him, I said, well, maybe you've forgotten the other part of the Christian story that says that it's a Almighty Sovereign God who controlled these people in creating that. And guess what? God doesn't need copiers and computers. So, I mean, you may reject that theory, but to ask that question is just senseless within the Christian worldview. But that just goes to show you, people think they can dismiss out of hand any consideration of the Bible because it's inaccurate, we don't know what it originally said. And that's a conspicuous mark of prejudice. People who say that really don't know what they're talking about. In fact, if you were to get into a discussion with somebody who knows something about textual science, and especially ancient studies, classical studies, they would never say anything like that. They would be utterly embarrassed to say that. But the more you read about the science of textual criticism, textual transmission, and so forth, the Bible comes off looking wonderful. It's a tremendously reliable, trustworthy text that we have in the case of the Bible. This came home to me with great force when I was a graduate student taking an advanced course on Plato at USC. Because in this course, one of the things we were compelled to do is to take account of the textual criticism of the literary corpus of Plato's works. And so let's just do a quick comparison here for a moment. Our earliest extant manuscript of a work by Plato by extant manuscript, we Plato wrote at a certain point, probably about 350 years before Christ. But now we don't have what he wrote originally. Someone copied and then copied and then copied and copied. Now our earliest copy, manuscript copy of what he wrote originally dates from right before 900 AD. This is the manuscript labeled Oxford B. It was found in a Patmos monastery by E.B. Clark. Now you have to remember, Plato wrote roughly 350 years before Christ. The first copy of what Plato wrote that we have is from about 900 AD. So now what's the span here? 12 centuries. 12 centuries. And yet I don't know anybody who's taken seriously in the scholarly world who would say we have no idea what Plato said. That 12th century gap does not stop people from writing long commentaries on Plato, arguing about the interpretation of his works. Every once in a while you get into textual criticism and problems, but again, it doesn't lead anybody to say, well, who knows what Plato really said? That is just not a problem. In terms of the ancient world and what we know about copying techniques and so forth, people are not greatly disturbed by a 12th century gap between the original writing and the first copy. By contrast, the earliest fragments of the New Testament date from 50 years after the original writing. So you have half a century over against 12 centuries. So by my math, that puts us at a 24-time power better position than Plato. The bulk of our most important early manuscripts dates from about 200 to 300 years after the original copying, or excuse me, the original composition of the New Testament. Here's some things you may want to get into your notes. Just list these and then we'll get back to talking about things. Codex Vaticanus, Codex Sinaiticus date from about 350 years AD. The Codex Alexandrinus from the early 400s. Note especially the papyrus fragments. First of all, the Chester Beatty fragment, where most of the New Testament can be found, dating from the early 200s. And then we have the Bell and Skeet fragments of an unknown gospel. Now, this unknown gospel is not canonical, but it has large block quotations from the canonical Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. So you can do some checking. And we know from the date of that manuscript, about 150 AD, that all of those Gospels were already available in circulation and being copied. The Rylands Papyrus, which gives us a fragment of John, the 18th chapter, is dated at about 130 AD in Egypt. That's significant. All the way to Egypt, we have copies of John's Gospel, which most people think is the last Gospel to have been written, already in 130 A.D. The papyrus Bodmer II has about two-thirds of John's Gospel, dating around 200 A.D. Now, you have to add to this evidence we have for the early dates of the New Testament books, quotations of the New Testament. In fact, nearly every New Testament book is quoted. And just these three church fathers, you have Clement's letter to the Corinthian church dating at 96 AD, roughly. The letters of Ignatius, about 115 AD, and the letter of Polycarp, about 120 AD. So before the close of the first century, or just barely into the second century, we already have quotations, not entire books, but quotations or fragments from all the New Testament books. We're not talking about 12 centuries. We're talking about 50 to 100 to 150 years. Now, when you get to 300, by then you have, in fact, manuscripts of the entire New Testament. And so when people suggest the text of the New Testament is unreliable, what they are telling you is, and they know nothing about ancient manuscripts, they know nothing about textual science, they are unfamiliar. Now, I'm not suggesting you should say that to them. Maybe you have to sometimes, but I'm not saying you should tell people you don't know what you're talking about. Well, let's talk about that. You say, well, are you familiar with, for instance, comparison with Plato? Later in the lecture, I'll give you a couple of other comparisons. and say, when do you think the first fragments of the New Testament date from? Ask those kind of questions. You know, play Columbo. Get in there and say, well, now, what about this? What about that? So you can start suggesting to people that maybe they have bought into a soundbite criticism that doesn't have any substance either. The text of the New Testament is remarkably uniform, remarkably well-established. And the reliability of the Old Testament, which was questioned by many pirate critics of the Bible, who only came to embarrassment in the 1940s and 50s with the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls. And so the overall authenticity and accuracy of the biblical text is, in fact, well known to scholars. Frederick Kenyon concluded back in 1940, and I quote, The Christian can take the whole Bible in his hand and say without fear or hesitation that he holds in it the true Word of God, handed down without essential loss from generation to generation throughout the centuries. Assessments like this one from competent scholars are easy to multiply. Casual critics are only showing their uneducated prejudice when they say, well, but you never know whether this text is reliable. Who knows what the original actually said? F.F. Bruce, in a well-known book, The New Testament Documents, Are They Reliable?, said about the middle of the last century, it was confidently asserted by a very influential school of thought that some of the most important books of the New Testament, including the Gospels and Acts, did not exist before the 30s of the 2nd century A.D. This conclusion, he says, was the result not so much of historical evidence as of philosophical presuppositions. Even then, back in the last century, he said, there was sufficient historical evidence to show how unfounded these theories were, as Lightfoot, Tischendorf, Fregels, and others demonstrated in their writings. But the amount of such evidence available in our own day is so much greater and more conclusive that a first century date for most of the New Testament writings cannot reasonably be denied, no matter what our philosophical presuppositions may be. To go back to Frederick Kenyon in another book that he wrote entitled The Bible and Archaeology, Kenyon says the interval then between the dates of the original composition and the earliest extant evidence becomes so small as to be in fact negligible. And the last foundation for any doubt that the scriptures have come down to us substantially as they were written has now been removed. Both the authenticity and the general integrity of the books of the New Testament may be regarded as finally established. Now, that was written in 1940, okay, over 50 years ago, and yet people will tell you today, well, of course, you can't trust the Bible. Who knows about its text? Get down and dirty. Ask some questions. Get beyond that surface or skin level of criticism and find out if people know what they're talking about. Say, well, now, are you aware of this? Are you aware of that? Let me ask you some questions here. Well, why are there so many variants? I mean, here you have these people saying you can count on the text of the New Testament. It's finally established. There's only negligible ground for doubt, the smallest measure about the Bible. And yet people are going to throw out the idea that, well, there's so many different readings in all of these manuscripts. How can you count on that? When I debated Dr. Siddiqui at Orange Coast College, his Islamic scholar, he pulled out his interpreter's dictionary of the Bible. You know, what a reliable scholarly source that is. He pulled that out and he said, it says here that there are 200,000 variants in the New Testament alone. And of course, his audience is going, wow. You know, and I'm sitting there thinking, you have no idea what you're talking about. Yeah, there are 200,000 variants. I'll get to the question of all of those and how they are counted in a moment or two. In fact, you'll see that number doesn't look terrible at all once you understand how you do the counting of variants. But 200,000 variants, what do we make of all that? Here's what F.F. Bruce said. If the great number of manuscripts increases the number of scribal errors, it increases proportionately the means of correcting such errors so that the margin of doubt left in the process of recovering the exact original wording is not so large as might be feared. It is, in truth, remarkably small. The variant readings about which any doubt remains among textual critics of the New Testament affect no material question of historic fact or of Christian faith and practice. Now, I'm going to whittle that 200,000 number down in just a few moments here. And once we get down to a really, 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 really small number, the interesting thing is, of those that have any semantic significance, they have no doctrinal or historical or ethical significance. There is not one Christian practice, one Christian doctrine, not one major historical claim of the Christian faith that's affected by any variant reading in the Bible. Now, if you want to do some of your own research, this is what I'm relying on to give you this quick summary lecture. You should pick up a book by Bruce Metzger entitled The Text of the New Testament, Its Transmission, Corruption, and Restoration. The second edition of that was published in 1968. Bruce Metzger, The Text of the New Testament. Or look at Norman Geisler and William Nix, also from 1968, A General Introduction to the Bible. I'd like to go over what the situation is in New Testament, in biblical scholarship with respect to the text of the Bible, give you what we are working with, and then you draw your own conclusions as to whether we should be, you know, shaking when people say you just can't ever be sure what the original said. With respect to the manuscript evidence, here are the following kinds of data that we have. First, obviously, biblical manuscripts themselves, manuscripts of the Bible. The Old Testament has survived in a few complete manuscripts, most of which date from about the 9th century A.D. These are, however, there are abundant reasons for believing that the copies we have are very good copies. And the reason why it's thought that they are good copies is that, first of all, there are few variant readings in the Masoretic manuscripts. Secondly, there is almost literal agreement in most cases between the Masoretic Hebrew and the Septuagintal Greek translation of the Hebrew, which dates from before the Masoretic text. And then what we know of the scrupulous rules and procedures of the scribe. Most people are not aware, for instance, that when a scribe would be writing the Old Testament, that they counted the letters on the line. And if the scribe had the wrong number of letters on a line, he had to destroy the manuscript. Now, how would you like that? You know, you're copying from Genesis, you get deep into Isaiah somewhere, and you get one letter off in the counting, destroy the manuscript because that has corrupted the holy word of God. When they got to the name of God, the holy name of God, Yahweh, the scribes had to stop, wash their hands, get a fresh pen, write the name, wash their hands again, continue. Now, that superstition is not something that was necessary. I don't support that. But you need to know that they have rules like that. They were meticulous about their copying. And that's why we're not too terribly worried about whether these late manuscripts are reliable. There's great similarity in the parallel text of the Old Testament. The Old Testament, for instance, will have the same account in two different places. And when you look at the text in these manuscripts, they're very close. But the most phenomenal confirmation I've already mentioned came with the discovery of hundreds of Hebrew manuscripts near the Dead Sea, which are much earlier than the Masoretic text, and it turns out nearly perfect correlation between the Dead Sea Scrolls and what we have in our Old Testament today. With respect to the manuscripts of the New Testament, we have many more manuscripts. And with many more copyings, many more manuscripts, you multiply the number of opportunities for mistake, to be sure. So the manuscripts we have are not as uniform as the Old Testament manuscripts, but we have thousands more. In fact, there are over 3,000 Greek manuscripts of the New Testament. Ask anybody, how many manuscripts of Plato do we have? 3,000 Greek manuscripts of the New Testament alone. Now, to that evidence, you have to add the versions of the Bible. A version, of course, is a translation of the Bible. We have a number of ancient and medieval versions of the Old and New Testament. The Old Testament is represented by the Septuagint. I've already mentioned the Greek translation. The Samaritan Pentateuch, the Babylonian Targums, and a number of other major ancient versions that contain a portion of the Old Testament. The Old and New Testaments can be found in the Old Syriac, the Old Latin, the Coptic, Sethitic, the Latin Vulgate, and then there are others to be mentioned as well. When you put all these together, there's about 9,000 manuscript copies of versions, which help us to compare to see if we have a text that's reliable and uniform. Now, to the biblical manuscripts and to the versions, you have to add the quotations we have from the Old and New Testament that are to be found, for instance, in the Church Fathers or rabbinic quotations that are in the Talmud. When you add all this up, just the extant writings of the Church Fathers in 2 centuries give us 36,000 citations or quotations from the Bible. And now you have to add to all of that evidence the lectionaries, the worship manuals that we have from the early church and so forth. Recent counts indicate that there are some 2,000 lectionaries available. The reason why the lectionaries are important is that much of the worship of the early church was a recitation of scripture, readings or prayers or whatever that came right out of the Bible. So that gives us early evidence, too, what the text of the Bible was to those who wrote the lectionaries. So now put all this together, the biblical manuscripts, the versions, the quotations, and the lectionaries, and it turns out that we have a grand total of 14,000 manuscripts containing the New Testament text and at least 36,000 patristic quotations. You see what I'm getting at? Get down and dirty with people. They want to suggest to you that, well, you can't rely on the text. You say, when we have 36,000 quotations and 14,000 manuscripts, it's highly likely that we would have gotten completely wrong with all that evidence at our disposal. And now, what about all of these variants? As I've indicated to you, people will tell you there's 200,000 variants. That's the highest number that I've ever seen given. It's often lower than that, but so you have one source that's supposed to be scholarly that will tell people there's 200,000 variants. Okay? How do you count variants? Let me explain to you that a variant spelling of the same word counts as a variant reading from a textual standpoint. But nobody has any problem with that. Shakespeare didn't. He wrote his own name 3 different ways. Anybody think, well, I guess Shakespeare was either an idiot, or we don't really know what Shakespeare wrote. No, we just know that there's variations in spelling. I remember when I was doing research on my doctoral dissertation, which was on the subject of self-deception, I ran across a manuscript by the Puritan Daniel Dyke. And Daniel Dyke wrote this, I thought it was fascinating, this book long ago in the Reformed tradition, The Mystery of Self-Deceiving was the title. But because of the period in which he wrote, self-deceiving is spelled S-E-L-F-E, deceiving. Now, when I would write that down in my notes, I would bet you dollars to donuts that I wrote it down the way I spell self-deception. But I don't think anybody who's looking at my notes about what Daniel Dyke wrote would say, well, it can't possibly be the same thing because they spelled this word differently. That's just a feature of human language. All natural languages go through that. And so when a later scribe gives a spelling true to his day for a word that he's copying, that counts as a variant. Now, it's worse than this, though. If that scribe copies, let's just say he puts the different spelling of self-deceived, that's not in the Bible, but to use that illustration, and it turns out that his manuscript is copied by 300 other people, you know what that means? You have 300 variant readings. That's how the count is done of variant readings. So, the New York Times, supposed to be a world-class newspaper, right? New York Times, every once in a while, spells a word wrong. Now, how many copies of the New York Times are made every day? I don't know. Thousands and thousands and thousands. You have to understand that if they misspell one word, and thousands of copies are made, and then hundreds of years from now, it turns out, let's say they had stacked up all these in a warehouse, and they never got destroyed, and we came across them. If we were doing textual science, we would count that as 300,000 mistakes, variant readings. Now, that's how the count is done. So when people say 200,000, that number, when you take away just variant spellings copied over and over, reduces immediately down. I mean, it's just incredible. So how did these variants occur? knowing how the variants come about is helpful, not only because we can restore the text when we see how mistakes were made, but it helps us to assess the significance of the number of variants that are there as well. There are two types of errors that textual scientists identify in variant readings. Some are unintentional, some are intentional. Among the unintentional mistakes, we have errors of the eye. Okay? We break words incorrectly. Have you ever done that? Well, you can very simply. I know I can do that. I type fairly fast, I think, and then I have to proofread what I type. And it's amazing. When I hand my manuscript to somebody else to proofread, how is it they found all these mistakes that I didn't see? How is it they found all these mistakes that I didn't see? Errors of the eye, which you expect. You go back over that. I didn't even realize that the E at the end of the got onto the next word, you know, rather than on the word the. That would count as a variant, however. There are omissions of letters. Why is that? Well, because when people look at the text and look over here, especially when you remember the lighting conditions under which these manuscripts were usually copied, you know, and I'm not, you know, poor mouthing it, all I'm saying is you just have to realize they didn't have the advantage of electric lights and all sorts of things, and they would write all day long. Not many of us have the stamina to write all day, much less to copy all day and to proofread our own material. But nevertheless, there are errors because of omissions of letters and so forth. There are repetitions, the opposite of an omission. Sometimes you take your eye off the page, you go back, and you write the same thing again. Forget where you left off. There's transposition mistakes, where words get inverted or letters get inverted, even by people who are not dyslexic. It just happens because of errors of the eye. Now, what happens when that takes place? If you were reading one of my manuscripts where I got that E pulled off the TH and shoved onto the next word, and you were looking at it, you'd say, have no idea what Dr. Bonson was saying here. No. Knowing how mistakes are made, you say, oh, that's an easy one. Shove the E back over here. Now you have the word the, and then it makes sense. But you can do that with these manuscripts of the Bible, with Plato, and everything else. When you know how mistakes are made, they're not hard to correct. There are confusions of spelling, confusions of abbreviations, scribal assertions sometimes get into the text as well. Then there are errors of the ear. Many times, because they didn't have copy machines, the way in which you could get a number of copies made quickly is to have people sit down and take down, you know, what a person reads. So one person reads the text, 10 people copy it. Well, now that means errors of the ear enter in. For instance, just give you one illustration of this. In Codex D, we have what appears to be an erroneous writing of may instead of met in the Greek in a reading from Mark 14:31. So instead of having, if I must die, you get, if it is not necessary to die. But you see, that's because the two Greek words are very similar, even looking at them. But the point is, when you're listening and you're in a hurry, you could easily write one down trying to get on to the next word. And when you see that in the text, again, knowing the similarity of the two words and what they would sound like, you can reconstruct the text fairly reliably. Now, there are errors of memory that enter in, too. And all of you do this. Every preacher I've ever heard preach does this. It would be called an error of memory, when in fact what it amounts to is we conflate text to the Bible. Okay? Without the shedding of blood. Can you finish that? There is no remission, right? But now in the New Testament, if you have the without the shedding of blood and then something else is said, it's not difficult for a scribe to fill in what he knows so very well. Not on purpose, just because that's the way he remembers the verse. So that's a variant reading, but again, not a great difficulty to figure that out. There are errors of judgment. Perhaps the funniest that I know of comes in an interpolation of 2 Corinthians 8, verses 4 and 5. I can't write on the board, so I can't illustrate this for you. If you have an early manuscript where a scribe has written out the text, but he has some question about something he's written on, say, line 14, and then he puts into the margin, are so many copies say, that would be a scribal note to the next guy who's copying. But believe it or not, sometimes people got very tired when they were copying, and the brain can almost go to sleep while the eyes are still picking up the words and the hand is doing that. Any of you who've stayed up late, you know, trying to get a paper done, you know, that's due the next day, know that that's very possible. So I don't even remember. In fact, when I was doing my master's thesis at Westminster Seminary, I was sleeping like 2 hours a night trying to get this thing done and so forth, and I sent it off to a typist to be put into good form. And a few days later, she called me and she said, you know, Greg, what you have written here makes perfectly good sense, but the footnote numbering is just all mixed up. The numbers jump all over the place. I was so tired that even though I could write semantically, I couldn't count. All right? Now, that happens. So, interestingly, in this case of 2 Corinthians 8, we have one variant, one manuscript that reads right in the text, it is thus found in many copies. Right on. Obviously, some tired scribe sees this notation in the margin and writes right into the text. So there are errors of judgment. Errors of writing take place as well. But in addition to these unintentional changes, we have intentional changes. Sometimes things are changed grammatically and linguistically to conform with contemporary style. I can illustrate that probably from your own liturgical experience today. In our church, we recite the Lord's Prayer nearly every Lord's Day. Okay, so now if I'm leading worship and I'm praying and I say, Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. That counts as a barrier, you have to understand, because you know, the King James doesn't say who art in heaven, but which art in heaven. Now, have I made a mistake? I don't think so. I prefer updating the grammar because people have such a tough time with Scripture anyway. But the point is that would count as a variant reading when all it is an updating to contemporary style. We have harmonization changes that are made by scribes who think that they can bring things into harmony by supplementing what's in the text with something in a parallel account from another gospel, let's say. We have that in the Lord's Prayer in the New Testament. Then we have scribes who think that they have to help the Bible be accurate. I don't approve of this, but we can see corrected manuscripts that try to get apparent historical errors out of the way. And then there are conflational changes, which are intentional. When a scribe runs into two readings, sometimes what he does is he goes, well, I'm not going to take the heat for making the wrong choice. I'll put them both in. So you get that. Then you get changes that come about because of particular parts of the church having distinctive practices. And one area of manuscript, one family of manuscripts that we have in the New Testament, in many places where you read prayer in the New Testament, you read prayer and fasting. But it's all in the manuscript from that segment of the church, which did what? Promoted fasting as a religious ritual among Christians. So that too helps when you have some background. So now we see why there are these differences, and they all tend to line up this way. The interesting thing is, as J.H. Greenlee, he said, no Christian doctrine, however, hangs upon any debatable text. And so how many variants are there? We started with 200,000. We actually can quickly reduce that down to 10,000. And then how significant 10,000, because variants take place at only 10,000 places in the New Testament. Those of you who are computer buffs, a place for a variant is a byte. So every spot on a line where a letter could fall, if there's a change, that counts as a place. And there's only 10,000 places where these 200,000 variants are found. And then you got to reduce that by which are only spelling errors, knock down the variant readings that are just, you know, updating the grammar or other sorts of things that are easy to deal with. Let me tell you what scholars will say about the number of mistakes that we have to deal with. Westcott and Ford said that when you look at these 10,000 places, of those that are substantial variations, mathematically, it comes down to, they said, we have a Bible that's 98.33% pure. 98.3. That ain't bad. But they were liberal in their estimate. Ezra Abbott said there's no appreciable difference in the sense of the passage
except in, of the variants, he said 19 out of 20 of them, there's no question at all, and 19 out of 20 of the 1/20th left are the only ones that have any kind of difference that makes a difference to the sense. And so now you have something that's even higher in percentage. Philip Schaff, who also did work on this, looking at the various variant readings, he said, of this total, not one of them affects an article of faith or a precept of duty which is not abundantly sustained by other and undoubted passages or by the whole tenor of Scripture itself. A.T. Robertson also did a count. He said, not a thousandth part of the entire text can be questioned. 99.9% pure in terms of textual science. So B.B. Warfield observed by conclusion, the great mass of the New Testament, in other words, has been transmitted to us with no or next to no variations. When someone tells you, you can't be sure what the Bible says, get down and dirty with them. Say, do you know how many copies we have? Do you know how many variants there are? Do you know how many of those variants are significant? It's less than 1%. There is not a document in the ancient world that comes anywhere close to that. And in the case of these other documents, no one has any question about them. Let me compare quickly before we end this lecture, the Iliad to the New Testament. You all remember the Iliad? You read it every once in a while? One of Homer's classics. Next to the New Testament, there are more extant manuscripts of the Iliad than any other book. And for the Iliad, we have 643 copies. How many copies of the New Testament do we have? 3,000. So there, that puts us way ahead in our ability to reconstruct. And both the Iliad and the Bible were treated as sacred texts. That may be hard for you to understand, but I'd have to go into classical studies to explain to you what Homer's place was in Greek society. The New Testament has approximately 20,000 lines. The Iliad has only 15,600 lines. Of the New Testament's 20,000 lines, 40 lines are corrupted. That is, there's some variant, some doubt that has to be dealt with. Of the Iliad's 15,006, there are 764 corrupted lines. That leads to a percentage of error, just textual variant problems, of 5% in the Iliad, which has less stuff to be copied. 5% over against less than 1% in the case of the New Testament. The national epic of India, the Mahabharata, has suffered even more corruption than the Iliad. It's about 8 times the size of the Iliad and the Odyssey together, roughly 250,000 lines, of which 26,000 have textual corruptions, fully 10%. So the Iliad has a 5% corruption rate, the Mahabharata, the 10% rate, and the New Testament, less than 1%. Is it reasonable for people to dismiss the Bible saying, well, I don't have to take this seriously because I can't be sure what it originally said? What would lead somebody to do that? Not textual science, not scholarship, not objectivity, but ulterior motives. And I think you can point that out to people. The alternative is for them to be equally severe on all the other texts of the ancient world and to conclude we know nothing of ancient history. We cannot be sure about Julius Caesar. We can't know anything. Because if you can't trust the text of the New Testament, if you're going to play by the same rules, you can't trust any text from the ancient world. That's how strong our text is. But this leads to another problem, which is the transition to my next lecture. Last night, we saw that people will generally dismiss the Bible because evolution has discredited Genesis. Well, it turns out evolution hasn't done anything of the sort. Then people will say, well, okay, but there might be another personal creator God that you could go to, so you might as well just follow Islam rather than Christianity. And then we say, well, do you know the message of Islam? Do you know the sorts of things that are claimed? Are you aware of the internal contradictions in the Quran itself? And so we can dismiss that claim, even though people who are, you know, heart and soul, you know, committed to the Quran may not be willing to be moved, you can reduce their worldview to absurdity. Then there are those people who say, well, okay, I get it. You can't follow the Quran. You're going to have to follow the Bible. But you can never be sure of what's in the Bible. And now we've hacked that one down, you know, successively. Say, why on earth would you not trust the text of the Bible when we trust these other ancient texts and so forth? Now you might think, finally, if you take an evidential approach to apologetics in particular, I'd say, there you have it. The guy's cornered. He's going to have to accept the Bible now. Evolution doesn't give him an out. He can't go to another revelation. He can't say the text of the Bible gives him an out. But then you see the unbeliever who doesn't want to convert. At this point, is simply going to say, well, yeah, look what's recorded in the text of the Bible. How could anybody in his right mind believe these things? I'll grant you that it really was written years ago and that we have an accurate text. But that text reports things like miracles. And since miracles can't take place, you can't trust this. When you all go to the supermarket and read some of these tabloid, the one that always got me is, you know, big letters. Woman gives birth to her father. For all I know, the text of that story is perfect. There's no corruption or anything. Does that mean I'm going to believe what the text says? So the unbeliever is going to say, okay, I grant you the New Testament, the Old Testament, make all these claims, but who in his right mind is going to believe that miracles take place?
This recording has been released into the public domain by the Bonson Institute. Duplication, sharing, and distribution is encouraged. For more information about the life and ministry of Dr. Greg L. Bonson, visit our website, BonsonInstitute.com, where we aim to bring into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ.